much as possible to what you've said and already give sort of a response. And I will start with a philosophical reflection on the actuality of mannerism, and then I will conclude with some remarks on mannerist gestures, some of which have been discussed by Franz. So mannerist art is generally not very beautiful. It's a painting of long necks, a sculpture of unlikely gestures, an architecture of exaggerated orders. But precisely of its monstrosity, mannerism constitutes one of the oldest problems in art history. I first encountered it in Deleuze's reading of Leibniz and the Baroque about 12 years ago, and I gradually grew convinced that it was not just a problem borrowed from art history, but also a problem at the heart of Deleuzian philosophy itself. And as I was already doing my PhD on Deleuze and Leibniz, I decided to see if I could develop a systematic concept of mannerism based on Deleuze, even if it remains largely implicit in his work. So reworking the implicit is precisely a mannerist gesture, as I will argue at the end of the talk. So in the slow elaboration of this concept of mannerism, I think I learned what it means to think as a philosopher, not about art, but with art, by relaying art in another medium and discipline, as we're more or less like kind of mimicking of a material by another material. And what I almost did not write about, however, was architecture. And that's why I was extremely excited to see some of my own ideas actually return in Franz's book. And what I liked about his book is that it is written in an extremely free-spirited manner. He's a real free thinker. Relays philosophical concepts from the point of view, very strictly, of architectural theory. I learned a lot from it also, because, of course, Franz is much better at describing things and what he actually sees than I am at the printing it to be a philosopher. And in fact, I thought there's something of the object itself, mannerism itself, that circulates in these transactions from art to philosophy back to architecture. You can call it grace. You can call it with the mannerist copia, or generosity, a certain elegance, or maybe a free and wild repetition. It's another concept I will explain. And what circulates is a figure of mannerism, a modality, or what Franz calls a habitus. So I want to thank the organizers very much for continuing this circulation. Also, what I learned from Franz is that all these abbreviations in architecture, Fies, is actually a very mannerist figure, right? Because you kind of a mannerization or modularization of the old scholastic seminar. Let's start with Bruno Latour. In his Compositionist Manifesto, Bruno Latour argues that the Anthropocene is closer to the 16th century than to the self-image of the modern world. Through a complete reversal of Western philosophy's most cherished trope, the domination of nature by the human subject, our societies seem to be playing the role of the dumb object, while nature has unexpectedly taken on the side of the active subject. This is what Latour says. Such is the frightening meaning of global warming. Through a surprising inversion of background and foreground, it is human nature that has become frozen, a natural history that is taking on a frenetic pace. And this image of the foreground sinking into the background that rises up of itself reminds us of the mannerist compositions of Tintoretto or El Greco. While in the classical Renaissance, clear and distinct forms functioned as humanistic representations of a storia, a narrative, clearly delineated from a natural stage, these forms now enter into a metamorphic zone in which it is no longer clear who acts and who is acted upon. In the crisis of the stable forms of classicism, Deleuze writes, well, he doesn't write it about mannerism, but it applies, it is as if the ground rises up to the surface without ceasing to be ground. And it means that from the brain to the planet, the human world continues to depend on its natural and traditional conditions, while at the same time, these conditions have begun to rumble with a life of their own and are now on the verge of becoming uninhabitable for us. So in a way, the Anthropocene means that we dramatize the surface of the earth. We pull pull it up, the landscape as Rustica, as Frans says. Timothy Morton puts it this way. Like a mannerist painting that stretches the rules of classicism to breaking point, global warming has stretched our world to breaking point. The intrusion of Gaia thus finally does away with the romantic concept of nature as an unavoidable grund of harmonious living. We live in a thoroughly synthetic planet in which everything becomes a sign of human inhabitation. It is a human conditioning. But contrary to being transformed into man's manifest image or aligning itself to our privileged conduits, this general anthropomorphism teaches us just how not alone we are. The whole Earth system increasingly turns out to be a patchwork of interpenetrating machines, from microbiotics to financial, digital, industrial, institutional, algorithmical, and infrastructural feedback loops, which are always fundamentally maladapted to humans as they are to each other. To speak then of the world as a problem of composition and synthesis is to break with the modern habit of making a strict distinction between the natural and the artificial. It is well known that the concept of art, or rather of the fine art, appears only with classicism in the 18th century, and that it is established on the exclusion precisely of mannerist and baroque art. Because mannerism is deemed either too close to nature. This is the paradox of the rustic style in a massive building, such as Giulio Romano's Palazzo del Te. Or it is too artificial. This is the paradox of what John Shearman called the stylish style, figured by Giovanni di Bologna, a serpentine figure. So in any case, whatever it is too kitschy, tasteless, and decadent. And much of the development of Romanticism and modern art would be based on subsequent dialectic between art and its historical other. In the spirit of Baudelaire, it has been argued that mannerism is both the negation of art and its convex mirror, as if modernity is driven by something that escapes it and that can only be rendered visible in an oblique way. However, we will see that even today, when artists and art theorists seek to move beyond the postmodern deconstruction of their historical self-understanding, the concept of mannerism retains its problematic status. Mannerism continues to function as a source and an element of contemporary art, but it remains without identity. And it therefore turns out that, after all, we have never been modern, and that the conjuncture just before the flight of modernity took off gives us a more adequate historical image of ourselves and our world. For that reason, perhaps the time has come to investigate precisely the nature of this convex mirror and revisit the question of what exactly is mannerism. So if mannerism can be said to be both too natural and too artificial at the same time, this is because it is a culture that, here I quote Peter Sloterdijk, that relished accumulations of all sorts. One of the main motives of mannerist art, Sloterdijk points out, is to bring to the fore the composedness or actual arrangedness of actual works. Instead of organic beauty and proportion, it gives us ugly and sterile deformations, highlighting that, quote, the artificial, the artful, the human-made non-human is always much too complex to be merely aesthetically and organically pleasing. At the same time, this formalism regains a natural quality to the extent that forms do not stand alone, but are folded, sometimes smoothly, but more often in a frog way, into their surroundings. What makes form interesting is the vital force that makes form vibrate in a friable and open field of nested compositions. Bodies out of bodies, works out of works, figures out of figures. Combining plants, animals, humans, candelabra, the mannerist grotesque is a labyrinth full of transformation, hybridity, creation, and disintegration. It's precisely to the extent that it exacerbates this tension between the artificial and the natural into a plastic continuum that mannerist art already seems to point ahead into a radically constructivist future made up of an infinite scale of entities that have no prior or independent existence. In the tradition of composite painting, for example, Frans' piece of Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan is typical of classicism. It is the organism of the sovereign subject, composed of individual souls who have emancipated themselves from the state of nature. social body, towers over the objectified earth as its master and possessor. Contrast this to the grotesque portraits of Archimboldo, composed as crowded tableaus of animals, fruits, and vegetables. In both cases, we are dealing with highly artificial compositions, but the latter no longer reflects the power of the human subject. Both designs are highly anthropomorphic, but the latter is no longer anthropocentric. Rather, heterogeneous elements that mingle nature and history now make up the portraits of Adam, Eve, princess, sense of smell, summer, winter, whole series. The shallowness, again, of the foreground and the flatness of the background emphasize the deep ambiguity between planimetric outlines and volumetric details. It is no longer clear what is ideal and what is real, or at least there is no privileged commitment. You take one element away, and the overall structure of the composition changes. What in detail appears as a full-blown organism, on another scale turns out to be a hypertrophied organ, cancerous, and hideous. So again, what we have here is a dramatization of the playing. Roland Barthes observes that it is the very method of composition here which disturbs and disaggregates the unitary development. Beauty, the development of form. Quote, what dooms Archimboldo's heads to an effect of malaise is precisely that they are composite. Not only does the figured head proceed from a labor, but even the complication, and hence the duration of this labor, are represented. Archimboldo's heads are monstrous because they all refer, whatever the grace of the allegorical subject, to a malaise of substance, seething or swarming. Swarming of living things, plants, animals, babies, whatever, arranged in the closed, packed disorder before joining the intelligibility of the final figure. This swarming evokes an entire larval life, germinal life, as Franz said. The entanglement of vegetative beings, worms, fetuses, viscera, which are at the limits of life, not yet born, yet already putrescible. So with Archimboldo, we see a nature out of control. Instead of being nicely compartmented in essences and accidents, nature turns out to be a continuous movement that invades and decomposes forms just as much as it provides their ground. The principle of the Archimboldesque monsters, Barthes writes, is that nature does not stop. So for nature not to stop, means, first of all, that it is no longer submitted to the Aristotelian taxonomy of genera and species. That is, the stable subordination of matter under form, what we call allomorphism. Instead, the world of the 16th and 17th centuries held as an infinite movement or generalized metamorphism. Philosopher of science, Alexandre Coiré, famously described this age as an opening to the closed world to the infinite universe. What seems solid now appears to be fluid, such that, as Leibniz had once put it, in each fish there is a pond that is itself teeming with other fish, and so on. But just as nature loses its stable identity, so does its opposite art, which becomes increasingly unlocalizable within it. In the 1930s, Panofsky had already pointed to the rise of what he called anti-human and anti-natural forces that meant a fundamental rift in a society, religion, economy, and art of the Renaissance, and that somehow needed to be made productive. Quote, the rise of these new forces, not the Baroque movement, but mannerism, means the real end of the Renaissance, and at the same time, the beginning of our own epoch of history, he writes this, 20th century. An epoch which is still struggling for an expression in life and art, which will be named and judged by the generations to come. Henceforth, art and the science of materials converge in a general ecology. Practices such as alchemy, ceramics, diplomacy, and composite painting. So it's true that all these practices were regarded as so many vicariances of nature, but their multiplication of nature into an infinite variety of modes or manners of existence effectively brings about a Copernican revolution in ontology. Threshold of modernity, mannerism is the ecstasy of matter. Again, it's a word that Franz also used when he talked about about the virtuoso brick. The brick becoming static. Brick continuously aspiring to forms that remain incoative and imperfect, implicit within it. Philosophically, this means that instead of leading back to an unchanging foundation, God or nature or the subject or being, it would be better to say that the different modes or manners rise up from being, this is a quote from La Bougeard, they rise up from being like the tip of the sword from the sword. The mannerist world is one of spontaneous duplications and reduplications that endlessly redistribute what it means to exist. Both in the 16th century and today, a more adequate model of design and creativity than the 18th century artist genius is therefore the mannerist alchemist, like Wendell Young. The end of the book, the penultimate sentence of the book exclaims, almost alchemy. So I want to know why almost. The mannerist alchemist becoming kind of a cosmic operator, obsessed with an experimental mixture of signs, materials, fabrics, and formulas, he acquires a taste for mixed connections, for trans and post-human hybrids, animisms, and controversy. A taste, in other words, for composition, creativity, and assemblage. As you may ask with Latour again, what are the multifarious intersections of politicians, activists, fishermen, sushi bars across the planet with the biological species and ecological territory of the red tuna, if not a monstrosity from the cabinet of curiosities, the mannerist Wunderkammer? Mannerism, then, is not another name for the postmodern condition. This is what I would call the digital grotesque. Rather, it is a different interpretation of modernism, one which may shed light on what it means to have been early modern, as well as a measure to the extent to which we continue to be modern today. Hans already referred to Colin Rowe, who spoke of a mannerist modern movement in which modern architecture discovers new ways of revitalizing itself. Nowadays, this intuition returns with the concepts, I think, such as metamodernism. Instead of parody and pastiche of early defined historical moments, clearly defined historical moments, other, more virtuous repetitions have already replaced the classical chronology by a wave that knows only singular manners, each of which revirtualizes the actuality of modernism in its own way. The rich revirtualization of modernism is then what would be. Just as historical mannerism was the hyperbole of the Renaissance, in which the mastery of primary geometry, or the human figure, was put to unnatural use, there is also a virtuous modernity in which any given material or technique is pushed to its limit and tested for further artificial becomings. And in this sense, mannerism is not just an imminent critique of the past, then, but equally an intensification of its genetic moments, and this is why I think Franz can say of UN Studio, Sahadid, Scarpa, Zuntur, and I think this is the most splendid formula in your book, and I want to talk a bit more about it, but it could mean that they are all explicitly modern, all implicitly mannerist. So what does it mean to be implicitly mannerist? Does that mean if today they are implicitly mannerist, then were the 16th century artists explicitly mannerist? Or are you always implicitly mannerist? What else would be the difference between mannerism and modernism? Maybe we can discuss this a little bit, but I want to say a few things about it. So as Franz points out, virtuosity is not just a matter of showing what a given material can do, but also what else it can do, what else it is capable. Every material is a body with its own mannerism, its own proper historically grown obstinacy. And this constitutes the implicit potential of its subsequent linear development or explication. To the extent that we already know what the end project must be like, the implicit is what is generally passed over. It counts as only the actual work. But in order to see what this means, I think it's always good to go back to the Ur text of mannerist disegno, Michelangelo's verse, in which he says that the best artist has no idea which some single marble does not potentially accept its mass, but only the hand, which obeys the mind, can accomplish it. According to the classical reading, the on mannerist reading. Michelangelo famously held that the marble already encloses the idea of the work of art, but it takes a hand that obeys the intellect to accomplish it. It would be the task of the intellect, the eye of the mind, to actively recognize the form of this content, and of the obeying hand to merely free it from the passive surrounding mass. But this presupposes, again, a hylomorphic worldview, in which the form is already ideally given and merely needs to be imposed upon an indiscriminate matter. The relation between the conception of the original idea and its execution will be limited to a single, to whatever we call representation. But what is it precisely that guarantees that the work actually represents the implicit idea? How do we go from the intellect to the hand? In all the repetitive operations and manipulations of the marble, what guarantees that the original idea remains the same? The answer is style. Style with a capital S. Style, style is always generic. Anybody can do it. Once you have an idea, you know what to do to carry it out in a certain major mode, call it a major modality. But style is really what matters here in the example of Michelangelo. For in reality, of course, intelligent design is, and this is Spiegel's argument, intelligent design is as obscure a term for artificial objects as creation is for natural objects. The unfinished or non-finito state of works such as Michelangelo's Prisoners does not refer to some prefabricated idea in general, but reflects the artist's virtuosity, insofar as the idea, virtually enclosed in matter, does not exist outside the manner of its manual, repetitive actualization. So I think there are two kinds of repetition in mannerism. Mannerism is always based on repetition. It always presupposes a more classical model. It comes after, right? Classically, representation is reduced to representation. You have something, and it's reproduced in another medium. The idea of it doesn't change, the image doesn't really change, the subject is of the artist himself is not put in place. But then there's also repetition proper, a repetition that is not reduced to representation. And that is where a uniform style with a capital S explodes into a diversity of manners, each in their own way capable of singularizing a given material. So it's only with repetition proper that the material itself, potential itself is changed. What the virtuoso adds to any given material or technique is precisely repetition. And what is repeated in manner, through manner, instead of style, is not the explicit, but the implicit. Michelangelo, I would say, is explicitly classical, but becomes here implicitly mannerist. Instead of sufficing to repeat the internal idea, that's artist intentionality, or the external object of given in nature that you reproduce in classicism. We have a repeated, these would be cases of passive repetition, where what is repeated is already given, repeated repetitions. The virtuoso is a repeater, repeating repetition. He is the repeater of repetition. He passes from the object of repetition to the subject position in repetition. And, well, here, but structures of what guides Michelangelo's hand, or the constant exchange between the eye and the hand in the kind of haptic process of making, is of course what we call the figura serpentina, the serpentine figure as the basic diagram, a basic way for the mannerist to contract the implicit, to draw the implicit out, but never in a foreseeable way. In a way, the idea here that the serpentine figure virtually is already there. It is the infinitization of the material itself and our perception of it. And at the same time, it comes out of it gradually in a constant rehearsed movement. Michelangelo, I would say, the figure emerges from natural rock growth both gradually and all at once, remaining unrecognized in a way, even as it factorizes the material process. So that's what basically by the figura separatinata is so important. It is a way of mobilizing a material, mobilizing a certain material. For example, Giordano Bruno, to quote another mannerist, the main mannerist philosopher, he will argue that in nature, or in rock, or whatever, there is no formabilità finite. There's no finite formability. Because, he says, form is an act. It is what is repeated. It is what is always in the making. It is a gesture. It is gestural. It is nascent. It's a matter of birth. Similarly, Montaigne will say, all stability is in the end nothing but a languid motion. So the task of repetition, of the virtuoso repetition, is to modalize matter. Mannerists are materialists, but not because matter in itself matters. Matter only comes to matter, then it only becomes felt. It only imposes itself on a process in a certain manner. And manner is the open-ended quality, or the aesthetic quality in which this happens. So I have a lot of things to say, but I should probably conclude sometime soon. There's a few quotes that came at the end. So here also the prisoners are done again with new tech, with 3D printing technologies, showing that of course what guides the maker is not the idea. You can also use other media within the media. Any strategy can work to capture singularities in the material process, to contract virtual, to contract signs that remain implicit, or signs of the implicit in a new configuration. Let me just return to this question that I started out with. These are just two quotes by Agamben, another philosopher, that is relevant here, because he has a very fine definition of mannerism, which I don't agree with, but it illustrates the difference between style and manner. Mannerism, he says, in the history of art and in psychiatry, we'll talk about that as well if you want, designates an excessive adherence to a usage or a model, stereotype or repetition, but at the same time, the impossibility of truly identifying oneself with it. And so style, which is always a major way of proceeding, a classical way, is disappropriating appropriation, sublime negligence, forgetting of oneself in the proper, do this the proper way. Manner, on the other hand, is an appropriating disappropriation, in presenting oneself or remembering oneself in the improper. So manner, in a way, is always hysterical. Another concept that Kant used. It's always a matter of suspicion. Something is hiding, it's something implicit. And the mannerist knows that he cannot explicate the implicit. Because the implicit is the source that he needs to revitalize, re-energize in a way, in order to be able to create something new. So the mannerist adheres to what Deleuze calls the ethics of intensive quantities. Never to explicate too much. Right? Because if you explicate everything, then the potential is exhausted. So in the explication, you constantly also need to work against what you've already mastered. You have to introduce what Agamben would call a certain form of inoperativity or impotentiality. So you want to linger in the implicit. You return to the implicit. You repeat the implicit constantly by undermining your own mastery, and that is virtuosity. Postmodernism, I think, only deals with the explicit. It repeats the past, it only repeats the explicit past. It only plays with representations of the past, and that's why it's sterile, cliched. Everything happens at the same level of sensation. There's no intensive shifts, there's no infinitization of perception, there's no hallucinatory experience, there's no they're becoming. A mannerism, or even a virtuosity, as the virtuosity of the modern even, the material, materials, techniques, tradition, anything can be constantly modalized, revirtualized. Does it mean that mannerism and modernism in this new sense are the same? Is the mannerism of classicism the same as the mannerism of modernism? That's my question, of course, for you. But I think the difference is that they have different relations to the past in the end. Or there's a dialectical shift, right? Modernism explicitly breaks with classicism. In a way, it thrives on the formless. But it doesn't mean that mannerism a role to play, as Franz has so eloquently shown. On the other hand, mannerism is an explicit continuation of classicism. It's always the same themes. Everything, all the variations, the deformations, the exaggerations, are all built on the human body as the basic figure, and the figure of Canata as the basic strategy to rehash this body. So you have an explicit continuation of classicism, but of course also an implicit repetition